everyone, and welcome to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Craig Couch, and every week it's my job to interview top performers and unlock the secrets of their success so that you and I can apply some of their thought patterns, daily rituals, and strategies to our own missions. My next guest is Todd Tarver, a motorcycle racer slash mechanic turned entrepreneur. Todd owns Straight Line Motorsports, which he founded almost 20 years ago. Over the years, he has grown his company into one of the top three largest KTM dealers in the country. He was a professional racer back in the day in the 90s and won the famed enduro race from Vegas to Reno in 1998. And his friends describe him as a teenager caught in a 40-year-old body. Todd, welcome to the True Grit Podcast.
Glad to be on here with you.
Yeah, man. Well, I have a bunch of questions for you. And something funny just happened because I said, hey, do you have your ringer off on your phone? And you said that you've had your ringer off since 2013. Tell me more about that.
Well, we're getting ready to go to our dealer meeting. Like, I think it was our third dealer meeting with KTM in 2013. So before we took off, I figured out how to forward my cell phone to the shop. And at that point, I realized after about 2 hours of the phone not ringing and the shop answering the calls and helping me with the staff at the shop, that I realized I was never going to unforward that phone again. So it's been that way ever since. I turned all the notifications off just to try to stay focused during the day. You know, so much going on. I do so much by texting to keep my sanity that when I pick the phone up, for myself is when I catch up. So I may have, you know, 10, 15 texts every time I pick my phone up, and I'll just clear everything and then go about my day and keep working. But it's the only way I can stay sane.
Yeah. I don't know how long mine has been off as well. Mine have been silenced. I don't think anybody that's close to me either, that's a friend of mine, has ever heard my phone ring.
Right.
Now it will buzz, like it'll vibrate in my pocket, but anyway, I really
not mine.
Yeah. You even have the buzzer off, huh?
Yes.
That's awesome. Well, one of the crown jewel races that you won, you and your team, I guess. I don't know much about this race. I've heard about it. The race from Vegas to Reno. Tell the listeners what that is. It's an enduro race, right?
It's the longest off-road race. It's not an enduro. It's a straight race from right side of Vegas and almost into Reno. That year, I think it was 519 or 529 miles. So I think we did it that year, right around 10 hours. Me and my now business partner and friend, and then another buddy of mine that backed it, and I'd always helped him with his motorcycles. He was part of the team as well.
And so this race, is it a stage race, or is it like you've got a team? Is there just one rider doing all that riding, or are you guys...
No, it was all three of us, and you relay, you pick out which legs you're going to ride, set up your chase vehicles. So your chase vehicles have got to beat you, which is hard to do because you're averaging a good pace. So yeah, you have to get through that each section for to beat the truck. You know, the truck's is so close. So we worked with two vehicles and leaped so that way we could actually be on time. If not, you're going to show up and you have to ride another leg because your next teammate's not there to give the bike to. So it's a big buddy race.
No kidding. Well, so how many racers are there? And you did it in 10 hours. How many racers were in that race?
Oh gosh, I don't remember. It's a huge event though. They start you off every minute, kind of like an enduro on the start, lets the dust settle everything. And then it's fixed time at the end. But, we knew who we were racing against. And so we knew where we were at. So we started like number four that day, and we just had to catch those that were in front of us to know that we were better than fixed time, and we knew we were in first. But it was pretty close. I mean, it was within 9 or 10 minutes at the end of the race, which a whole day of riding, that's not a huge margin. That's one little mishap could cost you that.
And are you allowed only one motorcycle?
Yes.
Only one. So if your motorcycle craps out, you're toast.
You're done. It's got to be reliables. That's part of the test too.
And is all of
definitely
the,
recommend it.
Yeah, is all of the race off road, or is there some on road sections?
It's all off road. You may cross the road in some sections, and they'll have normally a trooper or an event person there working the road cross.
And what were the kind of average speeds? So fast.
We averaged in the mid 50s, which is super fast. I mean, we had to change a rear wheel, stop for gas, change riders. But our bike would do about 104 miles an hour. There was a lot of sections that we were tapped on that thing.
Yeah. And what bike was it?
It was a 98 YZ400 the first year it came out. And luckily we got in with Ty Davis when he was with Montclair Yamaha, paid their support. And when we paid their support, Ty helped us with bike setup, let us know what to do. So it it definitely paid off using his advice.
That's so cool. What a great team event. I just admire that. So I want to dive into our conversation, Todd, with a name. And the name is Stuart Johnston. I'd like to know who he is and why he was influential in your story.
All right. He was actually my first customer that started using me as a kid. I was 13 years old, sold him a KX80 that I was done riding. He actually bought it for his wife, thought she was just going to follow the kid around on a go-kart so she could start the go-kart when the kid would go off in the field. And he asked me who would help him maintain the motorcycle. And I said, well, I'll do it. And he was kind of shocked that, oh, you will? I'm like, yeah. So I did his tires, his top ends, fork seals, all his maintenance. And to this day, he still comes to the shop, still a customer. Pretty neat to, I couldn't wrap my head around it then. I didn't understand it when everybody looked at me. It was funny when I had a customer that young that was paying me to do stuff. And it was pretty neat. He would tear stuff down, clean it all up, bring it to me all labeled and packed, which most mechanics don't like to put stuff back together. He's taking it apart. But he's like, I'll pay you the same. Just let me clean everything. Let me prep it. He just didn't trust himself to put things back together. So it was it was a neat deal, and it's good to still see him at the shop. He's getting a little older now, but he's still a great guy.
Well, so it's so interesting to me. So you're 13 years old. Where did you get this ability? Because is it just a mechanical mind or what?
Our whole family's got a bunch of mechanics. My grandfather, luckily, I lived in a garage apartment behind his house, and my grandfather retired when I was really young, and he worked on all the cars in the neighborhood, all the people from the church. So I couldn't wait to get home from school just to work on the cars with him to learn how to do stuff. I wasn't a fan of working on cars, but I liked mechanics and learning how to do stuff and applied that towards working on motorcycles.
That's awesome. Well, that's it. Turning a wrench at such a young age, I look at my own son and he doesn't have much interest in like the poor guy. I mean, if he has a flat tire, it's an issue. I'm like, man, I'll teach you. He's like, yeah, well, and I'm like, man, it's going to bite you one of these days. One thing that I'm really curious about, you've got this mechanical mind, right? And there's sort of a big difference between having a mechanical type persona and a mechanical mind and applying that idea to being an entrepreneur. And I'm really curious, was that a big jump for you? Because you were, you were basically a mechanic and then you transitioned into a business owner. Was that a big jump for you or was it a natural progression?
I ran an F&I department in a car dealership for a couple of years. That helped a lot with that side of my business, the sales and the banking and all that. The one thing I wished I would have done differently when I was younger, because I started working on stuff so young, I wished I'd have taken advantage of all those classes they recommended, like typing and computers and accounting. And I always had a dream, I was super young to have a motorcycle shop. And my idea of a motorcycle shop when I was young, when I thought I knew what I was doing, was I was going to be working on motorcycles. And now, you know, probably three quarters of my day is fixing book work, fixing, loading stuff, finding other motorcycles, finding parts that we can't locate that are on back order. There's so many things to my day that I never had a clue when I was younger, because all I thought I was going to do was work on motorcycles at the motorcycle shop. And it's definitely enlightened me a lot once I got the business open. The original shop, when it was a repair and accessory shop, it was easy. I mean, it was what I dreamed of. And then when I added KTM in 2011, it went to a whole other level.
Wow. Well, you know, you and Dina have been married for 15 years, and and I'm guessing that there's been some windows of time where you guys have had to make some pretty serious sacrifices. Can you describe some of those from your earlier days?
Yeah. So it was fairly smooth when I opened the original shop, and I met her after I had the original shop open. And then in 2011, we added KTM, and then I got really busy, tied up a lot. And one of the funniest things I look back at is in 2011, right after I was getting the shop opened with KTM and moving, we had a lightning strike at the house. And then I had to handle the house stuff at the same time I was moving to the shop. And I had to get my building purchased within a 2-year window, or the price was going to increase a ton. So I told my wife, we got to buckle down. So we didn't even turn the TV, the satellite back on after the house fire until we got the building bought. I just said, we're not putting any out. Everything's got to go in until we get this building purchase. And by the time, you know, a year went by, a year and a half went by, we said, you know, we kind of didn't miss the TV. And it was, finally, my son asked me, he's like, Dad, can I at least just get the Discovery Channel? So I finally turned the TV back on for him, that me and Tom, you know, Dean and I, we didn't care anymore. You know, we buckled down and kind of changed the way we did things.
That's
but yeah, it's pretty amazing transfer. You know, it was just like being tested, you know, when you're starting out. And it was tough to deal with the house and the shop at the same time, because it's, both of those are a money drain anytime you do a move or a remodel.
And when you say
had both going on.
And you said lightning strike, which means there was a fire, I'm guessing.
Yes, big fire in the garage at our house we still live in now.
Well, how did she respond to this buckle down period? Because that's less than glamorous.
Yes, she is 100% supportive of anything. Like if I want to change my diet, she'll hop in, she'll do my diet with me. If I want to change the way we're doing something, if we're racing, she goes races and she'll ride with me. If we go ride street bikes, she's in on that. We work really well together. And when she's busy with her work, I help her with, you know, her stuff. And then when she's not busy, she helps me with my stuff. So it's a good fit. Very good.
That's awesome, man. Well, there's a common thread really with all the entrepreneurs that I interview, is that there's always this really strong, supportive woman behind, you know, this adventure that oftentimes they didn't sign up for.
Exactly. Yeah. It's definitely, I've been able to do a lot more just to know you have that support at home. It helps. And you definitely got to have that support, or you're not going to make it.
Well, so in your journey, you mentioned something about buying a building and then the price of the dealership increasing if you don't move quickly, which likely meant you had to have some debt in there somehow. How did you deal with all of that?
So the first 2 years, I had to get the building purchased in the two-year time period, or the price went up a lot. So I had to buckle down, and I had to get 2 years worth of taxes behind me to be able to support that building and to be able to support getting a loan. And the gentleman I bought the building from, he was done leasing it. He was done renting it. It was, half of it was already rented to a long-term tenant that had been there almost 3 decades. So he only would sell me the building if I intended to buy it. And I had to talk him into leasing it with option to buy. And he only did that because my dad worked in that body shop that was the tenant. And he said, I knew your dad. I'm gonna go ahead and do this for you to help you get started. And I another good guy to help me get my business going, because without that step, it would have been another roadblock.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, you have, I think you mentioned the other day when we were having our pre-interview that you have a little over a dozen employees. So I'm kind of shifting gears and just what is your philosophy in hiring and keeping good people?
You know, I do my hiring and stuff a little different than most. One of the things I do when I'm interviewing somebody or talking to somebody, I always give them something to do. When we talk, I'll say, hey, when you go home tonight, that article you talked about or that eBay listing you said you've done before, will you email me that link? Or I always make them go do something, or call me the next morning at a certain time, or email me a certain time, or to see if they can follow through with that one task. Because if I'm away from work or they're handling my customers, if they can't email me back after the interview or call me back at a certain time, it's always some kind of task, then I'm out. There's no sense in hiring them. All my employees, I like to hire somebody with an intention. When they work for me, no matter what happens, we're still friends after they move on. And I don't ever let one employee just work in one position. Most people in our industry, they promise a lot of guys, hey, you're going to run this place in a couple of years, but they never cross train them. And I think what they do is they do that to kind of hold them back in their area, not make them any better. So they're not hireable for a GM or somewhere else. So I try to train my people to make sure that they can always do more, better somewhere else. And, you know, if they go somewhere else and make more money or get a better job, that's okay. That's, you know, we're growing our industry. We're growing our employees and our relationship. So they're never, when they go away, they're never gone. We still do stuff with our old employees. It's a neat relationship. It works for most.
Well, the cross training idea is really fascinating, because you would think, you know, a sales guy, for example, a guy that could really sell well, might not be mechanically inclined. Are you putting those guys back in the repair area? Were you guys doing?
Not so much working on stuff. Mm-hmm. I've got one guy at the shop two guys that do some sales that can do some mechanicking. But I at least want them to know, you know, the parts that I like to use in the shop, the setups we like to do, and understand it and be connected enough to the service department. So the customers, when they come in, they know they're confident in their sales guy connected to the service department. So, you know, people trust us with their bike setups and how they're going to build certain things. It just goes so much smoother when they can understand the service department when they're bringing in that bike to get it set up. Personalized for them.
Right. Well, do you
find, know, most of these dealerships, they don't have a clue. You go in there, they're like, well, I don't know. They just sell you the motorcycle and then they're done with you.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. I'm really wondering, is it harder to keep the guys in the service department or the guys kind of in the front of the store? Which element or which part of your business has a revolving door where it's kind of hard to keep guys in those?
You know, we don't really have a hard time keeping anybody. Almost everybody that's at the shop's been there a long time. Mm-hmm. My office lady, she's been there, gosh, I would say since about 2012. Bert and I, my business partner, you know, of course, we've been connected forever. Our graphics guy, you know, he's been there for 4 years. I mean, we have very little turnover. Our problem is now is pacing hiring to keep up with the growth.
Wow. Yeah. that's a good problem to have, but it is a problem. Yeah.
And you know, I had a good buddy of mine that owns a big dealership in Tennessee, and I've always seen the way he handled his employees. And, you know, he tries to make it personal with each one. You know, he impressed me I came in on visiting him on a Monday one time, And every employee that walked by his office, he knew what they had done that weekend, asked how the kids did at their games. And I just said, man, you know, I got to make sure I use some of that, you know, and make sure you know what's going on with your employees. Because, you know, if they're having a bad day or, you know, sometimes just a half day off work or, you know, hey, if they're asking for time off, there's normally a reason that they need to go fix something. It's not always fun stuff they're trying to get off for. You know, if they don't have their personal stuff taken care of, they're not good workers.
Yeah.
So, it's good workers definitely could use a couple more of them.
Well, you know, I've always wondered, you know, there's kind of a racing culture at your store. And then there's kind of guys like me. Who is your target customer? Actually, when you think of your favorite type of customer, avatar, you know, who's the perfect customer for you?
You know, I always enjoy some of my funnest ones are the guy that comes in, he started riding in his 30s, you know, and he goes out on the weekend and he tears some stuff up and he comes back just laughing. And, you know, he's like a 10-year-old, like when we were riding motorcycles as kids, and he started late in life. And it's funny to see that 10-year-old in a grown person, you know, and they're excited about what they tore up and joking about it, you know. And you get some of the fast experts or pros, and you know, they have a bad weekend. They come in just, you know, upset with themselves and hard on themselves. And you know, at that point, it's not fun anymore. They're doing it to try to, you know, win something or do something. But that new guy racing or that new guy riding is just so much fun when they got that smile on their face when they come in Monday picking up their broken parts.
Yeah.
But typically our you know, customers that we cater to are your 3 and 4 generation cross country guys and your racers, riders. You know, cross country racing, not just racing. Those people go out there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They spend the whole weekend out there. And sometimes it's grandma, grandpa, you know, and you got all the way down to the grandkids, the wives, everybody, the whole family's doing it. It's not just a race. It's they're spending, you know, almost every weekend together, you know, half the year. And most families don't get that. And they don't get that at home. So the motorcycles, the off-road communities, the long-term customers, you know, it works.
Yeah, that's cool. And it is, you know, I was a mountain biker before I started riding motorcycles, and I was that guy that would just break stuff and bring it to you and just be like, I have no idea how to fix this, but here's what happened. And I'd have your guys just laughing at my stories of just how I break stuff. So,
right.
but one thing I have noticed is that there is this really cool camaraderie. And I've ridden with other groups of guys that I didn't know before, and just, they're just all so helpful. And you're right. The motorcycles are kind of like the glue to a really cool community, and you're selling smiles, that's for sure, which is super cool. I mean, I get this vibe when I come into your shop. It's just really a lot of fun. And such a blessing to people. You know, my business and the real estate business, you know, it's pretty transactional, but there is an element of, you know, when we sell one of our houses to a family, it's pretty special. Like it's the part that keeps me going. It, you know, houses are kind of our glue. Motorcycles would be your glue. And I think you're really making a difference in the world. That's really cool. And the way you describe the generational thing is cool. I mean, these people are spending really good quality family time together, and you're a big part of that.
Yep, it's awesome.
Yeah. And one time you said that, that your business, you said in passing that your business was really like a reality TV show. what did you mean by that?
Man, it just, you know, we try to put that really professional face up front. You know, we try to greet all the customers, and we do a really good job with all that stuff. But man, sometimes behind the scenes, some of the funny comments and definitely with Bert and I, my business partner, sometimes people think some of the stuff I say to him, they think he's probably going to just shoot me one day because they're like, you really just said that to him? And we'll bounce stuff off each other. And people just think we're out of our mind. And some of the stuff goes on in the shop that we see, and some of the craziness behind the scenes with the employees of you know, working on stuff and things we see on the bikes and in the customers, some of the things that they come in and, you know, say or don't say, but you figure it out as you're doing it. It's definitely an eye opener when you get to see some of that stuff. We got a kid that's volunteering with us right now. He's just got out of the Army and he's just graduated from UTA engineering. He's hadn't started his engineering job yet. And he goes, man, I really like coming up here. He goes, I want to volunteer a day or two a week. Cause he goes, man, the behind the scenes up here, it's just so much fun. And he just wants to have some fun before he starts a real job. And he's been a big help for us. And it really, when he said that the other day, I was blown away that how much fun he was having up there watching us in the behind the scenes. And he was like, man, you guys look so professional up front. And then you guys just are cracking me up back here.
Well, bugging, you know? Yeah, I think a lot of people really strive for the culture that you've created, both on the front end and the back end. And that is a very good testament to have somebody just say, hey, I you don't have to pay me. I just want to hang out. You put me to work just because they want to be around that culture. What are there any particular strategies that people or mindsets that business owners can have to create a culture like you've created?
You know, it's a long-term process to build it. And it's been tough to maintain it as fast as we've grown. And just because we've grown fast doesn't mean it's making money. Sometimes when you grow too fast, it hurts you. You know, whether you're changing stuff or stuff's falling through the cracks. So the busy and the growth, not always great. So you've got to make sure you're keeping the environment going as that growth's going. And that's the stress time. It's hard to keep that. So sometimes, you know, we look happy and jolly up front and that we're just barely getting it done, barely paying the bills. And you're like, but you can't let that change your attitude. I mean, even if you've got to fake it, you've got to get through it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people can't do that. And they've got to, you know, put their heart to the side and say, I've got to keep my positive attitude and keep going. You know, years ago, I had a kid work for me. Another guy graduated college and he wanted to work for fun for 2 years. He said, I'll give you 2 years. I just want to hang out and work at a cool place. This was at my original shop. And it was early on, and we weren't that busy. It was the first time, only time I was never that busy. So he said, man, he heard me say on the phone that we weren't that busy. And I hung up the phone, and he got on to me. He said, don't you ever, and this is coming from my guy working for me. He said, don't ever tell anybody else again that you're not busy. He goes, nobody wants to be a part of a business or anything that's not active and not busy and not doing things. So I was like, oh, from then on, I went with it. And it's never stopped growing since that little bit of advice from an employee.
From a kid.
Yeah. I mean, he was in his early 20s. Yeah. And he's just like, don't ever do that again. Okay.
That's really cool. Well, so you've experienced tremendous growth and, last year was one of your best years ever. And I'm really curious about just the overall COVID drama and what effect it had on the motorcycle industry. What are some of your comments about that? Because it's been crazy for you, isn't it?
It has. And we had the first 2 weeks, you know, nobody knew where it was going. If it would have shut us down, you know, 6 weeks, I mean, they would have put half motorcycle businesses out of business, you know, quickly. just the margins so slim, you just couldn't do it. So we adapted the first couple of weeks. Any street bike I was working on, because that's what made us essential, was the street bikes.
Ooh,
up front.
Really?
First.
Okay.
So if somebody broke down on a street bike, I'd go pick it up. I didn't want them to put it in their garage. We want to keep those street bikes going. I want to keep them coming to the shop. That was my essential part. So, you know, somebody break down in front of the shop, guy with a fuel pump out of town on an adventure bike. Luckily, we had the parts in stock. In 45 minutes, we had them back on the road. The whole time during the COVID part, I was taking pictures of those guys with their license plates in front of the shop, you know, making sure I had documentation. That's why I was open. And then luckily, the Motorcycle Industry Council, after bicycling, got their stuff approved being essential. Motorcycle industry followed right behind them and used that example to make motorcycles, dirt bikes, be essential. So now, you know, if another pandemic happens, we know we got some protection now. But definitely an upswing in business. I think we sold 200 more units last year during the COVID stuff, and not knowing ahead. We did our dirt bike order at the beginning of COVID, not knowing which direction it was going. And I just told myself, I said, you know, it's either going to go really good or really bad. And if I have too many motorcycles and a bunch of people go out of business, it's going to happen anyways. So I took the gamble and I ordered super strong on the motorcycle order. And when the motorcycle started selling quick during COVID, I was one of the only people that had a ton of inventory. So that definitely helped me. I wasn't having to drive out of town to chase, pick up a bunch of units. I had them at the store. We were able to come in early, get them prepped. And we were doing 6 or 7 a day some days when we had the strong inventory. But it was all off a gamble. I didn't know what was going to happen with COVID. And it luckily went the direction it did for how busy we were, the industry in a whole.
Great move, man. I applaud you. That takes some guts. Cause like, right. It is like, that takes some serious guts. Well, what from a motorcycle industry standpoint, what caused the spike in demand? Is it just because people had more time on their hands? What in the world happened?
Time on their hands, getting outside. Like, you know, when COVID first happened, people kicking the ball out in front of their house, like we did when we were kids. You know, you hadn't seen that in years. You know, I had a family come in and bought 3 new motorcycles, all the gear, everything. The dad had a plan. He was going to do it after his kids got out of college. And he goes, man, everybody's homeschooled. School's shut down right now. He came in and bought everything. He goes, I'm 5 years ahead now. He goes, I'm doing it now. So it was cool to see a lot of that going on. People were doing trips that they were putting off because their life was too busy. And people are doing, you know, mountain trips and anywhere they could go, they were taking advantage of it.
Well, it's the same thing happened to the bicycle industry. I mean, the local bike shops that I frequent, I mean, they were out of bikes this summer. They had no bikes and like a 4-week wait to get your bikes fixed. I mean, it was something else. It's just totally amazing. Well, so you've built your dealership. You built this KTM dealership from, I guess you started in 2011. How did you become one of the top dealers in the U.S.? Explain to me how you were able to pull that off and jump ahead of the competition or the other dealers.
You know, a few things. I've always, no matter what we sell, we support it. Anything that I use that I like, the brands I like, the products, I stock all of it. If somebody wants something different that I'm not a big fan of, whatever, I'll order the customer anything they want. But if they want something that we use and we endorse and we like, they just come to the shop and pick it up. We've got it. They don't have to order anything. Parts for the bikes, all repair parts. If we've sold a repair part in the last 12 months for the bikes that we service, we stock it. We only focus on our niche of motorcycles, and we're a two-wheel shop. I don't do anything with four wheels. I don't get distracted with the side-by-side stuff yet. I understand that there's a lot of money in it for the industry. It's not my business. It's not my customers. So I would do a disservice by taking that stuff on and not following my motorcycle passion. And, you know, our service, you know, most of your dealers, definitely your KTM dealers, a lot of them don't like doing the big bike service on the street bikes. They sell them because they're forced to, but a lot of them, they'll schedule you out a week or a month, hoping you just go somewhere else. And, you know, we embrace it. We're like, you bought the bike from us. We support the bike and we get it done. We get people drive from, you know, states away sometimes to work on their adventure bikes, and they'll stay the night. We'll service them up, send them home the next day. And most people won't do that, you know, because stuff happens and we get, you know, get in there and something breaks or something's wore out. You know, things do happen, but for the most part, we turn them around in a day and send them back home on your, you know, stuff that we can get done in a work day.
Yeah. Well, were there any, I mean, because KTM has a huge, huge following out there. Were there any surprises when you became a dealer in 2011? Because I'm sure it was such a big deal to you. I mean, you rushed to buy a building to pull it off, to meet their requirements. Then you get the dealership. What were some of the top surprises of like, oh, I didn't expect that?
You know, just cash flow is always a tough one. So as you're learning stuff, you know, I'm taking trades in. And at first, my flooring that does my new motorcycles didn't floor my used motorcycles. So as I'm getting trade-ins in, now I'm having to pay off that new unit. And I've got $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 sitting in each of these trades. Then I'm getting stuck on some of these trades because I can't floor them. So my money's out. So, you know, you make very little on a bike sale anyways. You know, we don't charge the freight and prep. So there's minimal margin left on the bike. We expect customers to buy the parts, accessories to make up the difference. So as we're getting buried in these trades, our cash flow is tied up in those things. So there were times, that was one of my biggest learning curves. Because at one point I had like, you know, $40,000 worth of bills due, and I had $50,000 worth of used bikes. And I was like, man, I'm not going to make it through this little hump. And I remember I had all these trades. I had all the parts of the shop to fix them, get them ready, you know, send them to the auction, whatever. And I remember one morning I went to bed that night. And I was like, man, this is not going to work. And I finally about 3 o'clock in the morning, I just woke up and I said, you know what? I'm going to work. And I got to work that morning about 3:30, lined up all those trade-in bikes, started getting them ready, put grips on them, everything I had to do. I mean, I had guys working the shop, but I needed them done right then. I needed that cash flow back. And, you know, I worked till about 10 o'clock in the morning on those bikes, sold a couple while I was working on them, you know, because once they're fresh, the way I like them, they sell really easy, but they just needed attention and they needed to be done that day to make ends meet. And, so like I said, I popped up at 3 o'clock in the morning when I thought I was going to fail and just had to hustle them and make it work that day. And that was one of my learning that used part, getting my flooring set up for that was probably my biggest surprise. Cause that was probably put me in the biggest bind. And when that bind hit me, it was instant. I was like, uh-oh. And barely pulled that hump off. And now it's been a big focus to keep that balance in check.
Right. Wow. Well, so when you have the KTM dealership designation, what kind of protection do they give you as a dealer? Because there's not many of you out there.
No, and we've actually, they've added a few dealers here and there, but they've actually lost. It's kind of interesting. During COVID or right before COVID, they lost a lot of dealers. They didn't add back all the ones they lost. And they're actually numbers went down for amount of dealerships, but the quality of dealerships that they have now are much better than they were 10 years ago. So their sales actually went up. So it's been really good. And I'm okay. A lot of dealers get mad when they set up other dealers in areas and stuff. You know, to me, I'm not that competitor like that. I want to see the industry grow. And if we get another shop that can support another 200 motorcycles, I can't support without staff. I can't keep growing the way I am. We need other good serviceable dealers. and we need to grow our industry. I mean, there's going to be a shop. We'll add six people over there, and each rider they add, they're going to settle in elsewhere. They're going to use all of us from time to time. So we need added shops. We need good shops. And I try to help all the other dealers that I can help with stuff too. And people always think it's nuts that I will actually get on the phone. I'll help a dealer with their order. I'll help them, you know, diagnose something. I've gone and done walkthroughs, people's rehabs of their buildings, and they've asked me to help with their layouts and stuff. And people are like, why do you help your other dealers? I'm like, man, it's our industry. It's not competitors. It's our industry. We have to help each other.
Wow. That is really, really, really great. And it's rare. I don't think it's that common. I think it's common among the successful entrepreneurs to behave that way, which is totally counterculture. You know, this dog eat dog world is just brutal. I mean, it can be really, really brutal and cutthroat, and you're running the opposite way. And I think you're blessed by that, which is super cool. So, when you have a product like the KTM motorcycle, which is in super high demand, it's a high demand brand. What is your, and you have some exclusivity, you've got some protection. What is your marketing philosophy when you have a product like that that people want so much? How do you advertise, and what is your best ROI for your?
Yeah, so it's been kind of funny with advertising. I've never been one to pay money on advertising. The only article, so some of our vendors require us to have to set up with them. They want to see an ad. They want to see your business card, your tax ID, your picture of your building. So years ago, one of the things was always when we still had print media stuff was they wanted to see an ad, one of your ads somewhere. So I had a buddy who had Whole Shop Magazine, and I always gave him $50 every quarter for my business card ad, the back of his magazine, just because I had to have that set up accounts. I've never paid in advertising. You know, I do my stuff on Facebook or social media now, but it's always been grown off reputation. You know, people knowing who we are, knowing we're, you know, if you go on Facebook and read about somebody looking for a part or a service, I don't have to chime in. Our customers do it for us. And that's where it spreads. I like the word of mouth, referrals, all that, because that's solid. When they come in, they're already your customer when they come in. Mm-hmm. And you've earned them based off of your reputation. And they, you know, we get guys that come to the shop two or three times because they drove 2 hours away because no other dealer had a part in stock. And finally, they're like, you know what? I'll come up here every 2 weeks. I'll make the drive. I just want to be at the shop. I want to come buy my stuff here. And, you know, stocking the parts and providing the service keeps customers coming and keeps it growing without the money in advertising, which, you know, most people have to spend a ton of money on advertising budget. And that's one thing we don't do. We make sure we take care of our customers, and our customers do it for us.
I love it. Well, and you've got a really robust service department. What percentage of your revenue comes from the service department relative to new bike sales?
It's probably a third. Really? It's one of the best generating parts of the business. Mm-hmm. And you know, like I said, we just try to stay focused on our stuff. You know, you get a bike that's older than 10 years old. If I don't know the bike, you can't really work on it, because you could fix half a dozen bikes in that time. And most of the guys with the old bikes, they don't want to put the money into them to keep them what I call a serviceable unit, you know? So you got to make sure you keep your focus on the service department, or you can bury yourself in time. So you just gotta be real careful not to take those odd things that you don't know about. And if you bring it in and you've got somebody you can sublet the labor to that you trust, mm-hmm. to keep the flow going, keeping the time flow in service is key.
Yeah. Get them in and out, turn and burn, baby. Well, so you also finance a lot of bikes, I'm guessing. I'm a finance guy. I'm always, wondering, you know, you and I exchanged text a month or so ago, and I forgot what the answer was, so I'm going to ask you again. What of all the bikes that you sell, what percentage are financed, and And how does that work? Is it better for you to finance them, or is it better for someone just to come in and stroke a check for a bike?
It's actually on our deal. So KTM has one lender that they like to use, and we've got a great relationship with them. It's not like the car business world where, you know, dealers market up interest rate and all that. It's super clean, which I like because the customers can trust it. They just pay us a little flat fee, I think it's 1% or something. So, you know, bikes that we might get, you know, $100 or $150 bonus for doing the contract with the bank. So, you know, some people say I'm a cash buyer, maybe the best deal. Sometimes the finance deal is actually a better deal for us. Mm-hmm. It funds cleaner. There's never a bounce check, you know, in a good relationship with the banker. And it takes us an extra 30 or 45 minutes, but the funds are all secure. You know, it's good for us with the bank. But, you know, probably still half the people or a third of the people still come in and write checks for them. It's pretty shocking that people that can still pay cash for some of these dirt bikes that are $10,000 now.
Yeah, they are expensive. Well, you know, as you look back, kind of reflecting back on building your business, were there any particular decisions that you made that set you back? In other words, and you learn from, are there any sort of favorite failures of yours in all your years?
Probably one of my toughest love-hate deals, and it's still going on now, is my graphics side of the business. It's, you know, we do motorcycle stuff. We also do signage for other industries and stuff too, but mainly motorcycle graphics and decals. And I don't have the time to run it like I run my dealership. So I've got a couple guys that run it, and it's a tough deal because we don't make enough in it, but it's a cool asset to our business for the customers to be able to dress up a cool motorcycle and everything. So I keep it more so because the customers stay excited about building their bikes with their custom graphics and everything. But it's definitely one part of my business is actually probably cost me a little money, but in the long run, people enjoy it. So it's why I keep it.
Well, I can tell you
a hindrance more than an asset.
Yeah. I'm definitely one of those guys because, man, I made two of my dirt bikes. I mean, they look like billboards for all my companies. It's hilarious. I mean, they are beautiful and your graphics department did it all, but that's interesting because it's, you know, it is a little bit outside your lane, right? You really were earlier, you were real adamant about it, you know, sticking with two wheels only. And this is just, you know, this is kind of an art department, which is it is exciting though. I'll tell you, as a customer, I'm like, this is so rad. Cause all I do now, if I get a new bike, is I just, you know, they've already got all my logos on file for all my stuff. And, you know, they've got all that stuff ready. So if I get another bike, they can knock it out quick. It just kind of is one of those things that you use to service your customers, which I think is cool. You know, back in my 20s, one of my passions was outdoors and fishing and fly fishing. And so, you know, I thought I'd open a store. And that's what I did. That's why I moved to Fort Worth. You may not know this about me, but I had an Orvis dealership, which is sort of the KTM of all things fly fishing. Nice. But it did something really interesting to me. You know, when you make your passion your vocation, it can make you less passionate. You know, over the 10-year period, and I lost my butt, man. I mean, it was terrible. It was really good for 6 or 7 years. And then about year 8, it took a turn and it almost jaded me in a way, because now I almost look at fly fishing and I'm like, I don't care if I ever fly fish again. How do you keep from that kind of burnout happening?
So I had a really bad burnout in 96. I'd work on everybody's stuff. I was going to the gym 4 times a week. I was riding once a week, mountain biking once a week. Work, it was just too much. So I quit for about 8 months. Bought me a jet ski, thought I was gonna do something different. And then I came back and raced a little bit of motocross, and then had a house fire as a kid, quit racing, and got in the car business. I had 4 years in the car business, and I think I only rode two times in 4 years.
Wow.
And at that point, I realized I missed it so bad. And so I just told myself, all right, I'm going to open a shop. And I was going to start out just doing suspension only so I could just focus on me riding again and having fun. Before I turned the lights on at the building, I had people dropping off stuff. They heard I was going to start working on bikes again, you know, because a lot of people I helped as a kid. I had more work in the shop. I had a month's worth of work dropped off before the lights got turned on. And I went, and they're like, no, you're not doing just our suspension. You're going to do everything like you did before. And they kind of got it. And I just went from, you know, it's called straight line suspension to SLM racing. I shortened it real quick and just said, we're going to go, I guess we're going all in. And I told myself going into that, that if I ride twice a year and make a really good ride, whether it's Colorado or dual sport ride or some cool event twice a year, that's better than twice in 4 years. And I've kept that. And now, I mean, the first time I think I met you was on a Colorado ride.
Yeah.
You know, I saw you with your brother, and that was one of my big rides that year.
Yeah.
And it definitely kept me good now. Cause some people see the way I work, you know, sometimes I'll work 10 or 12 hours a day, and I'll work 7 days a week for 3 or 4 weeks. You know, my wife still cracks up at me because in the mornings I'll pop up out of bed like, hey, come on, let's get the day started. I'm going to go work. And she's like, how do you still do this? She goes, it's almost been 20 years. And you pop up in the morning, and you're ready to go to work. And I said, I like it. Love it. You know, and just being around the motorcycles and the motorcycle people. It's awesome.
That is so cool. I'm glad. Yeah, it sounds, you know, I remember that trip, and I was, you know, I was fairly new rider, not new to two wheels at all. And I was leaning heavily on every ounce of mountain bike skill just to keep up with you guys. I mean, I had it. It was an incredibly good workout just trying to keep up with you guys. It was super fun. Well, I want to wrap up. I usually wrap up my interviews with some fun rapid fire questions that can take a minute to answer, or they can just be one word answers. So the first one is 2-stroke or 4-stroke?
My wife says if there's a need for both, you need to have both.
Well, so that's really funny that you say that. In the bicycle world, there's a formula for how many bicycles you should have. And the formula is basically S minus one. So equals the quantity of bikes that you should have. And the S stands for separation from your spouse. So whatever you can get away with, minus one, and you're good to go. And right now I have 3 motorcycles. So ever thought about adding more locations?
No. I would like to, but I can't run 2 locations the way I run my 1 location. And I don't want the customers to suffer. I am helping a buddy set up a location that I'm going to have some upside of his business. No liabilities, but I'm helping him on the side basis. But I'm not going to be totally connected to that one. I just want to, he wants to build his off my business model. Mm-hmm. So I'm helping him from scratch. And setting this thing up. We're in the process of doing it now. We're still probably 60 days out of getting him launched. But yeah, I don't want my customers to suffer. And, you know, some guys say, man, you need to open one in Dallas. You need to open one in west of Fort Worth. I'm like, yeah, but every time you guys need me, I'm going to be at the other store.
That's exactly
It wouldn't work.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty wise of you, actually. Coming from a guy that had 3 retail locations, it was terrible. And it was the death of my business. It really was. So let's see, why not Husqvarna, by the way?
You know, there's just a lot of red tape and a lot of stuff going on. The Husqvarna riders need it. They need a good service dealer. You know, they've got one decent, a good service center up in McKinney, but that's too far for most people down in this part of the Metroplex. but they definitely need a shop like ours, whether it's us or somebody else, but they need it. We did add gas recently.
Oh, I did not know that.
So we are growing. Of course, I haven't told many people about the gas yet. They're starting to come in on the floor, but I did a huge stocking order because I've known for having parts in stock. And I don't want to launch it and tell people I've got it if I don't have my parts to support what I'm selling. It's just not my business model.
Such a great play.
So,
well, what is your favorite kind of riding? Is it the mountain riding you did, or is it, what is it?
I'm probably a little ADD, I guess. So, you know, I started out racing cross country as a kid, you know, and I had some good invites to do, you know, dual sport rides through the years and different things. Before I got KTM, I started doing a little vintage racing. So I do stuff for about a year or two, and then I totally switch gears. So it's just the two wheel thing. And I enjoy all of them. So I went on a dual sport ride in 16 because I had a trade in, and I thought dual sport riding was for old people. Now I just realized when I go dual sport riding, we kid around with my group. My group's called the 100 mile an hour group because we're all out there hauling, and it's all a bunch of us old racers that are all out riding. It's a long day of riding. We eat lunch halfway through the day. Sometimes meet for breakfast, and we call it a dual sport race. We all go out and just have a great day of riding. And so now I'm like, man, all those cool trips I missed because I thought it was just a bunch of old people, you know, and now I've done some enduros and I just change my mindset all the time. And I got customers that do it all. So I try to break my time up, you know, do a year of this or a couple of years of that and just try to keep it interesting.
I love that. Variety is key. Well, so let's, this is the last question. So there's a jet parked at Meacham. It's big enough to carry what you want. Meacham Field waiting for you, to take you somewhere. Where would you go? And what would you take?
You know, right now though, my main bucket list trip right now is I still just want to go to, down to Costa Rica and ride. That's my next trip I want to get knocked out.
Oh my God. Well, you know, I speak fluent Spanish and can ride a motorcycle and have been to Costa Rica several times. I spent months there. So I'm your Huckleberry, perfect, bro. Let's go.
There we go.
It's so fun, man. Well, Todd, this has been such a fun interview. I've been watching your business grow over the years and you make it look easy. And thank you for letting us peek behind the scenes and pointing out some of the less than glamorous parts of building a business. And I know you've really encouraged other entrepreneurs with your transparency. Do you have any parting thoughts?
Man, I'm like, you know, anybody in my business that I can help, I'm an open book, man. I'll help anybody, you know, just reach out to me. Cause I definitely don't want to see any business in our industry fail. Cause the industry needs the support and we need to keep growing it. So, like I said, an open book, I'll help anybody.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thanks a bunch, Todd. We'll see you soon. I'll come by the shop.
All right, man.
All right. See you.
All right. We'll see you.
Well, folks, that wraps up our show for this week. If you found this interview helpful and would like to get pearls of wisdom that I've gathered along the way, go to truegritpodcast.com and subscribe to the True Grit blog. You will get short, helpful emails written by yours truly. Included in these posts, you will also get the show notes with links to books, articles, and other cool things I run across. Thanks as always for listening to the True Grit Podcast, where we believe that personal growth and helping each other solve important problems is the best way to make the world a better place. And don't forget, building a company and a life of meaning takes true grit.